All right, welcome. Hey, you can hear the audience out there. We are live. Welcome to the Atheist Experience. It is Sunday. What the heck is it?
The first.
It is July 1st.
It is July 1st.
Yeah, I looked down there and I saw 22, 26, and I'm like, there's not that many months. So, and I don't know how many months days are in the 22nd month. Anyway, well, it's July 1st when we're recording this. You may be watching at a later time. I'm your host, Matt Delaney. Joining me this week, Phil Session, the greatest volunteer in history.
Whoa.
You were out there this morning again, right?
I was out there.
And you're wearing your atheist helping the homeless.
Oh, sure. Wow. Sorry, I just looked to my. I sure am there, repping the Austin AHH, courtesy of, this is a Foundation Beyond Belief shirt, as a matter of fact, for our efforts down here in Austin. So it's pretty cool.
Awesome. So this is the Atheist Experience. It's a live call-in program. The phone lines are all full, so if you haven't called already, you can ignore that number that's down there under Phil for the time being, although we'll try to get through some callers and open up some lines. And we are sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin. I'm not going to go through a laundry list of announcements, but I know you have a couple of things that you wanted to mention quickly.
Of course, of course. As always.
They're always good things. Phil does good. I'm okay.
So it is. You're all right now.
See?
I just wanted to mention, as I always do, the upcoming volunteer stuff. As Matt mentioned on today, there was the Austin Atheists Helping the Homeless just this morning. We were out there. It was about 22 of us out there, and we served about 200 people on today. So it was pretty cool. It was very muggy outside, and so you sweat right off the bat. And that's just for us that were outside for a while, let alone people that are out there the entire day kind of going through that. So we went through all our bottled water, all the hundreds and hundreds that we had, and hair grease was a big thing out there. I gave my last bit of hair grease from my bag to someone. We ran out earlier, but one person came up and I was like, if you don't mind it, use. It's about half gone, but here's the rest of this here blue magic. And she was all about that. It was pretty, a really awesome moment. But this morning I was out at San Antonio Pride last night and had a wonderful time and didn't get home. It was a late night. Just admittedly, that was my fault. You know, it's the way it goes. It was good stuff. But
see, that's a problem.
I went to bed at like 4 or so and had to wake up at about 7:30 or so this morning to get up here and get some things. But as I was getting ready, I'm just like, kind of peeling myself out of bed. But once I got out there to the giveaway and all the energy that's there and all the conversations that you have, it brought me right back to why I want to be out there in the first place. And all of that fatigue kind of went away. Came back later, a few hours after
that. Sure. But, let's see, you party, then you get up and you do a bunch of good, which makes you feel good. Then you get to a board meeting.
and it crashes down.
Yeah.
But anyway, so coming up, we have on the 28th, the first blood drive that we've had in a long while for the ACA, as a matter of fact. But about a few miles away from here is a blood donation center for We Are Blood. And so we'll be hosting a blood drive where each person that comes in to donate, you'll get a free movie pass to Alamo Drafthouse. So you get a movie of your choice. You just get a ticket that you can just use at the gate and then go see whatever movie that you would like there. So it's kind of a little perk. But once you go there, you can sign up online. But all the information is on our Facebook or our Meetup. If you want to make an appointment, you can also just walk in. But they said that you might have to do some longer wait times if you actually walk in on that side. So grab an appointment if you want a more firm time to get up there. But that information is online on Facebook and Meetup on the ACA. Just let them know that you're with the Atheist Community of Austin so they can tally you and make sure you get your free movie pass when you actually donate that blood. And the only other thing I wanted to mention is Austin Pride is coming up because I'm all about the Pride life.
What's the date?
It is August 25th, that Saturday, the last Saturday in August. And so we'll be out there again with our booth. I'm getting some more swag together. I'm trying to we've got hand fans, and we've got koozies, and we've got, the rainbow bracelets. I'll be bringing lots of beads, as I always do, but I'm trying to get something different, maybe some tote bags or something like that. So try to change things up and give people a little more to take home. So
you know, it's Austin. the weather here is nice pretty much year-round. There's about a month or so where it's almost cold.
It doesn't last.
And then there's a month or so where it's miserable hot. You would think that if you're organizing a Pride Festival in Austin, you would not do it in August or July.
No.
You would like, hey, let's, I know you're trying to avoid the, and you're not doing it, but I mean, I know we're trying to avoid the major holidays, but anyway, when do you put it? You can't put it spring break, can't do Christmas, can't do these. So I guess we're going to do it in the heat forever. But you've got Austin Atheists Helping the Homeless. There's also Humanists at Work that are down there underneath on Sundays as well.
Third Sundays of the month.
Then you got a blood drive.
Oh, yes.
Then there's the Ramp Project.
Yes, we'll be doing another one in August if it's not too hot. This month, I'm probably going to skip because we've had some issues with people, you know, being dehydrated, like just kind of, it gets intense out there for a while. And so for the safety's sake, I went ahead and pushed back, and we'll kind of see what the weather is kind of looking like if I want to schedule another one during these heat-intense months. Because even with a canopy or something to stop the shade, people can have some problems, and I would rather avoid that if at all possible. So we did one in San Antonio, but it was a small one, quick, 4 hours in. We were out of that, but even so, it was still very hot.
I think it's kind of funny that the blood drive is basically giving people tickets to a bar. I mean, Alamo Draft House, yes, you can go see a movie, but they serve alcohol. So it'd be the first time I donate blood and they give me tickets to a bar. But anyway, along with those efforts, there's a bunch of other stuff going on. You can hit atheist-community.org to find out what the ACA is up to, including the ability to come down and watch this show and participate in all kinds of outreach events. We'll be having dinner after the show, and we're here. 1507 West Koenig Lane, any atheist or atheist-friendly person is welcome to come down. But the next time somebody talks to you about how only churches are charitable or atheists and, you know, humanists aren't giving and all that, just introduce them to Phil, and he can give you a list of all the stuff that's going on just in our town. And this is going on everywhere. And,
yes.
And literally, I mean, Beth had made 1,000 hats for the homeless. There's like 75 left in bags, and I know nobody in Austin needs hats right, knit hats right now, but they will for that month that's cold. There's a lot going on, and there's, you know, we were asked last week, Seth was here for the 1,000th
right,
show.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I guess this is the 1,001. So maybe we should change it to 1,001 and Atheist Odyssey instead of Atheist just for today. But one of the questions was asked was about volunteering, and we mentioned, you know, that there's plenty of opportunities all over the place. I don't know that we mentioned these as much as getting involved in organizations and putting your skills to use, even if your skills are only being here and, you know, being a smiling face to welcome other people and maybe encourage friends to come or set up chairs or, you know, help clean the place up afterwards, advertise, keep the books for organizations, stuff like that. So there's always more room and more people.
Right. So if in your local area, like Meetup is a pretty good resource, at least for finding secular groups. And so is like the United Coalition of Reason, their app and their website to kind of see who's in your area. But check with those local groups to see what kind of volunteer efforts they do. I coordinate volunteer activities out here and also for the Freethinkers Association of Central Texas down in San Antonio. And, you know, taking people out to the food bank for the first time or for Haven for Hope, the big homeless transformational complex they have down there to serve food, which people really get a kick out of, but they didn't know that that was a thing they could even do. And so I love introducing people to things in the first place, and the fact that it's a secular organization just kind of puts that cherry on top
that's
happening there. So it's pretty cool when people read your shirt and they're like, oh, what is that? When I was getting food, actually, after the board meeting, I went to go get a burger or something like that, and one of the servers behind the desk, she read the shirt and just kind of looked. And she looked and backed away a little bit, and I was kind of preparing for it because you don't know what you're going to get.
Right.
But she was like, I really appreciate what you're doing for the homeless. And I was like, oh, thank you for that. You know, we just did something this morning. And so she got more information, started asking about what do you actually give out and going into that. So it was pretty cool.
It's one of those things where we're asked on occasion on the show, but primarily like in emails or if I'm out doing an event, people will ask, you know, what's the most important thing that we could do to, you know, help the secular community? And I think I have the same answer every time, which is to be out, because that's what gets to normalization.
Yeah.
If you're walking in, oh, I'm wearing my American Atheist Convention T-shirt, or I'm wearing my Monster on Sunday shirt, or whatever. And, you know, some of them are less obvious, and so they ask questions. But, you know, I mean, you don't have to get, you know, the Out Campaign A tattooed on your forehead. I'm sure somebody probably will, but
I'm just sure out there.
And because not everybody is in a position where they can be out, where they can be comfortable.
Sure, sure.
And the more people who are, the easier it becomes for others to join in as well. I'm sure there's people on the other side of the glass sitting here in the studio who may not be as out as either of us or some of the other people here, merely because we haven't yet built the kind of world where you can go, oh, yeah, I'm an atheist, and not have any fear of, you know, losing your job, losing your friends, losing your family.
Right.
That type of stuff happens. It's not the most common thing, but it's out there. And so we got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely an effort to make on that side for being out, if you can be out, and especially doing charitable works and other people seeing that portion really starts changing the narrative about what people think about what atheists are and what morals you have, what activities you engage in, not just baby eating or whatever else, but actually being productive members of the community and society as a whole.
Yep.
So,
on that note, I got one more announcement to remind people of, and that is that we have launched a Patreon project, or Patreon page, for both this show, patreon.com/theatheistexperience, and for Talk Heathens and our various other efforts. And I just did an interview with Mr. Atheist last week, which is coming out in pieces. Here's what you get. I don't know. I know that as a patron, you have access to ad-free content and patron-only content. There's probably going to be bonus stuff. Mark and the crew have been actively uploading our back catalog of lost episodes, episodes that haven't been there. They've also been chopping them up into more, you know, bite-sized portions, I guess.
Yeah. More easily digestible pieces versus a huge...
And so you can go there, you can donate, you can help keep this alive, keep the lights on, pay for the other stuff that's going on around here, and keep the library open full time. But also, it reminded me, we get a lot of feedback, and we appreciate people who write in saying, you know, that they appreciate the show, but we also appreciate criticism, preferably as constructive as possible. But there's one thing I want to caution people about. We get feedback about technical issues. We get feedback of, oh, the video quality here was awful, or the audio quality here was awful. If you're going to do that, by all means do it. You can email tv@atheist-community.org. But include the information about the actual episode number and take a look, because there were people who were reporting problems from an episode 12 years ago just because it was uploaded, you know, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's a new upload doesn't mean it's new content. You can tell because there's, first of all, if you just look at me when I'm on the show, it started as Fat Matt with hair and then graduated to Fat Matt with less hair, and then there was a thinner Matt for a while, and then it went back up, and now it's going back down. So just judging by my size and the background's probably better. If it's got this background, it's new stuff. And there may be newer backgrounds as well. But we do appreciate the feedback. Just try to give us enough information so that we can figure out, hey, did we screw up in something new that we produced, or is this something we've already fixed? Because the guys in the studio have done just absolutely stellar work, fixing the audio, getting the new caller system set up, getting, you know, being able to communicate with the booth. Better lights, better cameras, green screen. It's almost like we're not doing this in somebody's garage anymore.
Almost.
All right. On that note, I want to go ahead and start taking calls, and we will start in New Jersey with Nicholas, who helped us out pre-show making sure the call works. So how you doing, Nicholas?
Hey, I'm doing great.
All right. Thanks for calling. What was your, did you have a question or comment or something?
Yeah, I did have a question. All right. So what is the end goal of your show? And why do you guys take pride in your work if you're granted 80 to 100 years to live? Why do you take pride in your work?
What would you say the end goal of the show is?
I don't know.
Oh, no, I'm asking Phil. Sorry.
And I don't understand why you guys would curse God and you're given lips. It baffles me.
All right.
It baffles me.
One question at a time.
Okay, we'll start with what's the end goal of the show.
All right.
For me, I'm sure like each host has their own take on, you know, what they want to get out of the show. But for me, it's about having a conversation with individuals, actually talking about lots of issues that you may not regularly hear about in your regular conversation. This may not be something you hear about around your table or at work or whatever else. But being able to explore different ideas and be exposed to something that may be different from what you currently believe, and actually have a conversation about that and adapt to new information. If it's something that's credible, if it's something that's substantiated, to, you know, start making room to adopt that claim and to have that conversation. Also to talk about volunteering stuff, because that's just what I love to do, and spread that word out there. But for me, it's about having a conversation with people, and it's not necessarily, you know,
but how is having
every
conversation
hang on,
the
hold
world
on.
A better place?
Hang on, we're answering your question.
Yeah, it's not that you're going to necessarily change every mind that's there, but having, you know, having a discussion, actually having a civil discussion, and talking about different things, even if you disagree. And number one, it's a skill to develop in the first place, but it also may help you to get to better information as the end result. You know, it may not—it's not guaranteeing you to get there, but you know, it may not help you, but it may help someone else.
And I will add to that and answer your other two questions all in less than 30 seconds. So I agree with what Phil's saying. For me, the end goal of the show is to make the show obsolete, to make atheist activism obsolete, because we live in a world that is rational and secular. Why do I take pride in my work if I'm only granted 80 to 100 years to live? First of all, from a biblical standpoint, you're only granted 70 years. I don't know how many years I'm granted, but I take pride in my work because I am confident that it has a positive effect, and I enjoy it. And I enjoy my the amount of time that I live is irrelevant. If I could die tomorrow, and I would still be proud of what I'm doing right here today. And why would I curse God if I'm given lips? I don't give a care about God at all. I don't think that God exists. I don't think that God gave me lips. I'm happy to curse God primarily because the people who are convinced that he does exist and is real and gave me lips seem to be bothered by that. And that motivates them to provide an explanation for why I should care about a God.
All right. I respect both of your answers, but I am not convinced.
You're not convinced of what? You think we're lying?
I don't think. No, I believe what you guys are saying, but I'm not convinced. Like, I will always believe in God.
We weren't trying to convince you that God doesn't exist. We were answering your question. We weren't trying to.
Understand how your work will make the world a better place. I don't understand how kids will get better by not believing in God. I don't understand that.
Why do you think, do you think kids would be better off if they believed in God?
Yes.
Why?
Why do I think kids will be better? If you're in the world, you're most likely to sin.
Well, I'll go. So first of all, which God are we talking about, right? Just for clarity?
Jesus Christ.
Okay, so if kids believe in some other God, are they in trouble? Okay.
Bickering and small talk won't make the world a better place.
Questions like asking people why they believe what they believe won't make the world a better place?
Asking, do you believe in Zeus? Like, bickering and small talk is nonsense.
When
you ask questions... do you believe in Zeus? I am rational. It's nonsense. You're given 80 to 100 years. Why do you take so much pride when death is around the corner? Tomorrow is not promised. I do not understand why you would curse God, and you're given lips, you're given eyes to see. Did you know about the junior's death? Like, don't be ungrateful of your
sin. Did I know about what?
The Bronx teen, the one that was slain. What do you think about that situation? And that evil exists in this world. What do you think about that situation?
I have no idea what you're talking about, but the fact that there's evil in the world or that people do evil things is just a fact.
Okay, what's your thoughts on people doing evil?
It's bad.
Why do you think it's bad?
Because it is not beneficial to society. It does not improve the quality of life.
Well, Hitler didn't think that.
What do you mean Hitler didn't think? You realize that...
Stalin did not think that. Hitler did not think that.
First of all, I'm having difficulty, Nicholas, and I don't mean this to be insulting, but I'm having difficulty. I'm having difficulty believing that you are actually honest and sincere in this conversation, and not just trolling. Because.
Okay.
All I'm trying to do is ask questions, and you're deflecting to 20 other topics. How is Hitler relevant to any of this? I'm asking you. The question that I asked was, would the world be better off if kids believed in God, and I wanted to know why, and now you're talking about... You said yes, but I wanted to know why, and instead you went to Hitler and a bunch of other stuff.
Because you asked the question with a question, so I said yes.
And then I asked, why do you believe that?
Because I believe in everything that I say. You're not really living life if you don't believe in everything that you say and in everything that you everything do. You're not living life.
So you're dying
if you don't believe in what you're doing and what you say.
I asked you for a reason why you believe that, and you said because you believe in everything you say. Do you know what a tautology is?
No, and I...
You should go look it up, because you did not give me any...
It's nonsense.
Nate, you did not give me an explanation. All you did was restate that
Even
you believe it.
If I were to give you an explanation, with your attitude, you would refute. I already know where you're coming from and that mindset.
See, the
you
thing is,
regardless of
I already know where you're coming from, because I was a Southern Baptist.
Know where we're coming
I
from,
do.
I'm going to refute.
Nicholas, I was a Southern Baptist and was going to be a preacher. I know the Bible backward and forward.
But we are both, we both agreed that we're both going to refute it. So we literally have like 5 minutes left. So let's keep going.
Keep going.
No, let's not keep going. Goodbye.
I'm about to say, where do we go?
First of all, you don't tell me how much time we have left. Second of all, your call was an utter waste of time, because when I ask you why, instead of providing an explanation, you just said, because I believe it. Well, so what? That does nothing.
And what kind of point is, because death is around the corner, you know, why do you take so much pride? You know, why wouldn't you? If you only had, you know, whatever finite, you know, 60, 70, 80 years left on this planet, why would you not want to invest that or use that time to make an impact? I mean, I've said that on multiple podcasts or whatever else in regards to my volunteerism, for example. That's a thing. Like, if I'm only going to live this time, let me have this impact. This is what I want to do. It's what makes me happy. And I take pride in that and love doing it. And we'll be going out to do more next week, I'm sure, doing something. Who knows what I'm going to be doing?
Meanwhile, Nicholas is the one that's in a hypocritical position, because, first of all, he thinks he's going to live forever, which makes this life meaningless and useless for anything other than a stepping stone to get to the real life. Second of all, if he actually thinks that death is around the corner, he has all these concerns, why the fuck are you calling us?
Right. Right.
And if you're going to call us, shouldn't your goal be to defend the gospel of Jesus Christ, to go forth unto all the nations, to follow 1 Peter 3:15 and be prepared at all times to give an answer for the faith that is within you, instead of just saying, that's what I believe? You're a miserable failure as a Christian. An utter failure. And as a caller, which is why we're moving on.
Believing everything that you say in order to live. I don't even understand. What does that mean?
Hey, we've got Don in Los Angeles. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, John. Well, you know, I was, talked to Jen and Russell at the last part of February, and I got to tell you, I was shot down within 5 minutes, which was really bad for my ego. But my wife said that my problem was I didn't state what I was going to talk about it, and then follow up with what I talked about. So I'm going to use what I know of theoretical physics to redefine what God is.
Why?
To the point where, why?
Yeah, and the reason I ask that is this. First of all, neither one of us are physicists. But if you're using theoretical physics to redefine God, what does that get us, redefining God?
Well, it gives me insight as to what the actual question is. I was a atheist for a day back in the 60s, and I went to a Jesuit college, and I tried on atheism, and I realized atheism is a stepping stone to something else. It tells us what things aren't, but it doesn't tell us what things are.
Yeah, but atheism, I agree, is nothing more than not being convinced that a God exists, but it's not supposed to tell you anything about anything. But atheism, in the sense of I'm not convinced that a God exists, how do you fix that by redefining God? I mean, if what we're rejecting is all the various gods that people have... Hang on. If we're rejecting all the various gods people have been proposing, it would seem that redefining God... You could define a God that I would be happy to say is real.
Well, that's my point.
Yeah, but I mean, you could say this bottle of Coke Zero, which I should be getting paid for drinking all the time, you could say this bottle of Coke Zero is God, and I will agree with you that this is real, that it exists, but it doesn't have any of the attributes that have normally been considered godlike. So if you redefine God in such a way that it's real, what does that do for the broader conversation when there are billions of people who believe in a God that doesn't necessarily match up with your redefinition?
Well, maybe we can redefine it in such a way that people can accept it. First of all, before I go on, like I said, I was an atheist for a day. And then I got exposed to Buddhism, and then I read, are you familiar with Alan Watts?
Yeah.
Okay. That was a seminal book for me because it told me, the actual purport of the book was to say that it's impossible to be God.
Well, okay. Under certain definitions, but go ahead.
Yeah. And so when I was trying to define what theoretical physics said, this is a consensus. It starts off with the Big Bang. It was very hot, very dense. Entropy was very low. And then we had the expansion, and we're in the universe we have now. And the projection into the future is that matter will pretty much go away. Things will become very cold. There won't be any interaction. There won't be any definition about how big the universe is.
Sure. I'm fine with the notion of the standard model with Big Bang cosmology that ultimately results in heat death. Mm-hmm. Those are all physical attributes of the world in which we inhabit.
Right.
There are no variables. Yeah. There are no variables in physics that X equals God. So what is it about this that allows you to come up with a definition of God?
Okay, I'm going to have to jump into what God isn't, okay? And you're writing a book right now, I believe.
Yeah, I'm much more interested in what God is, because the list of things of what God isn't could take us forever.
Well, okay, let me just define what God is. It's impossible to be God, given the standard definition of what God is.
Hang on.
Okay.
If you say it's impossible to be God, then doesn't that necessarily mean there is no God?
There is no God in the sense of what we typically think of God. So let me just redefine what God is, okay?
Okay, give me a definition of God.
God is that which exists. Existence is existence. It's a tautology. Existence is existence. And so we can call that God because the whole set of that which is, and just call it God. It has no attributes that we usually consider what God is, which is all-knowing.
Okay. That is an absolutely useless definition of God.
Why call it
God? If you say God is everything that exists, we already have a label for everything that exists.
Right, and it's existence, right?
Existence, yes. And so why call existence God? Why use a different label? That label has to bring something or add something.
Well, okay, so there's a bit, this is kind of a joking reason. I'd like to run for public office, and I can't call myself an atheist. That's one throwaway, dumb idea.
Okay, hang on.
The other thing is...
Hang on, Don.
What? No, stop, Don. I'm just joking. Okay.
Atheists can run for office in the United States.
They'll never get elected.
They have been elected. They have... Oh, my God, stop. Stop!
Okay.
They have been elected. I agree that it's more difficult to be elected. But if the goal here is to say, I'd like to be elected to public office, and I don't think my chances are very good if I call myself an atheist, therefore, I need to come up with a definition of God that I can say I believe in, then you are being utterly fucking dishonest, and I wouldn't vote for you no matter what your policies are.
I know. It was a joke. Okay.
You called the show, John. You called the show, and you want to make an argument for redefining God, and I'm trying to give you every opportunity. So, drop the jokes and just say what it is.
Okay. When Alan Watts came up with his book, The Book, he was defining the fact that it was impossible to be God because there's nothing changing. There's nothing, all knowledge is at one time, all potency is all inclusive. And can I just lay down the rules of existence?
Why?
Can I do that?
What? So first of all, I asked you to get back to defining what God is, and all you did was restate the same damn book report that you gave me 30 seconds before that.
Yeah.
Get to the point.
The point is that when we're talking about the thing that Alan Watts talked about was the God game. You said you're familiar with Alan Watts. I don't know. It's He was a Taoist way back when, and it made a lot of sense to me, because when we think about what the normal notion of what God is, it's being omniscient, omnipotent, and all the attributes that we think of being God. But when you think of what it is to actually be God, you find out that it's an impossibility. You cannot.
I swear to the God that you're redefining, if you go down this same repeated thing one more time, I'm hanging up on you. Get to the point.
The point is that existence is. It's a tautology.
It's pronounced tautology, and of course it is, and that has nothing to do with the definition of God. You got one more shot, Don.
I really am surprised that I'm only getting one shot at...
One more shot. And now you blew it. Because I'm a man of my word, and if I ever do run for office, I will not be trying to redefine a God in order to help Buffalo people into thinking that I'm electable.
But why? Okay, you say it's existence. Well, then what? Like, what? Where do you go from there? I'm not sure what... You get any attributes from that? Or any directions? Any morals? Like, there's...
If they're co-equal, if God equals existence... Then you've added nothing to it. That's the point I was making. If you want to say God is existence, you would have to, in order for God to be something distinct, it would have to be God is existence plus.
Mm-hmm.
And would like to find out what the pluses are, because there's no reason to call it God. And it is dishonest and confusing, because if, for example, let's say the overwhelming majority of people on the planet think that the sky is blue. I don't get to redefine blue in an attempt to prove them wrong. I have to address their actual claim. And that's true even if the majority of people on the planet define God as the Omnimax thing, as the classical, the God of classical theism, that's all good, all powerful, all benevolent, or all knowing, etc. If that's that, I don't get to create a new definition of God and pretend that I am either arguing against theirs or that mine is essentially the same as theirs. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, it makes no sense. It doesn't get you anywhere. It doesn't add anything to the conversation. You're just trying to substitute another word for existence, and it's not adding anything. It's not doing anything at all.
By the way, if God is existence, this exists, and it is God. You basically made an argument that this bottle that I was talking about before is God. My flower garden is God. That tree is God. I am God. Oh, wait, it's impossible to be God. Therefore, existence is impossible. Don, you got some work to do.
Yeah.
We have Anna in Michigan. Thanks for waiting. Hello?
Hey, Anna.
I'm here.
Okay.
What?
Whoa.
My finger was like on the button.
It was
so
there.
Welcome
it was
back.
There.
I'm sorry, I muted it and then my screen turned off. Oh.
Thanks for waiting. You're on with Matt and Phil.
Matt, you're super intimidating. Oh, my gosh.
I'll shut up then, and I'll let Phil talk.
Oh, dear. Yeah, go for it, Anna.
Okay. So, really quick, your first caller, the question here is, like, what's the point of your show? I'm an atheist. I was sort of on the cusp of being an atheist for, like, 10 years, but I had a run-in with a really toxic theist, and I was like, oh gosh, what's out there to like learn about religion? And I found the Bible Reloaded with Hugo and Jake, and I was like, man, I'm definitely an atheist now. But so I just wanted to thank you guys for existing, because you kind of give people atheists who don't know exactly what's out there, what communities are out there. They look, what's out there, and they look on the internet and they find you guys, and you're sort of an outlet if they don't have a lot of, or if they come from religion, they don't have a lot of other outlets. But okay, so I guess to my question, so I was kind of wondering. So there are people who were religious and then come to atheism and then sort of teeter-totter on going back to religion just because, you know, being an atheist, at least for me, is a little scary because, man, what is my community going to think? What's my family going to think? What am I going to be ostracized? That sort of all those thoughts running through your head. Like, isn't it just easier to suck it up and go to church once a week, or if you're a Christian, or observe all these other holidays? Isn't it just easier to be a theist? And even if you don't believe, I was curious if you guys had any thoughts on that, or if you had any advice for somebody who might just be thinking, it's easier to call myself a Christian, and even if I'm not really sure about God or all of that.
I mean, it's definitely it can be not as straightforward as you would want it to be. I mean, in a perfect type of world, you know, someone can come out as atheist and you don't suffer any ramifications from family or from job or anything else, and you're just fine. But that's not where we are at this time. There's a lot of little things that can come into place. Your family, you know, they could ostracize you. You could be that kind of black sheep in the family where you come to gatherings and, you know, they might gather to pray and they kind of look at you like, you know, we thank the Lord, you know, as they kind of look at you or something like that to kind of, you know, make you feel some kind of way about that situation. And so it's hard to say. Depending on situations, there are some situations where people have to think about their own safety. For example, there are a lot of places where if you would come out, you may be threatened with verbal or physical assault. And so in those cases, it may indeed be easier until someone can escape that situation and be able to, you know, live truly and freely the way that they wish to. It may be easier for them to do so. Those that are dependent on their families or parents for financial support, if they're in college, for example, they may be an atheist and, you know, they go to rallies or do something in secret, but when they go home to their families, they may be, you know, the same Bible-believing person that their family knows, and just for not wanting to risk their livelihood going forward. So it's a very tough question, and it's so hard to give advice when I don't know your situation in particular. For us to do, you know your situation better than anyone, but just in a general purpose, it's up to you to kind of evaluate your situation, all the things you can lose, whether it be your job or, you know, if your boss finds out, could they take, you know, some kind of action against you or something like that, giving you more work, or, you know, firing you, not hopefully not directly like that, because that would help violate some laws. But it's just, it's very difficult to go about that. It's really a hard choice, and it really comes down to the individual looking at their own situation and evaluating the risk that they would take for coming out. And that's why it's so important for those that are able to come out to do so as to help normalize atheism in general, so that other people coming out in more questionable situations may not fear as much backlash, or the backlash may be a lot better. I mean, coming out as gay, that depending on when you did that, if you go back a few decades, you could be disowned. You know, but people still, that was in the 90s and the 2000s, like the Trevor Project was created for people that were kicked out of their homes because they came out as a part of the LGBTQ community, and their parents or their caregivers didn't accept it and kicked them out, and they had no place to go, no resources or whatever else.
If I'm not intimidating, can I jump in for 1 second? I just wanted to make it clear that there's a distinction. So whether you're a theist or whether you're an atheist addresses only whether or not you are convinced that there's a God.
Sure.
That's completely separate from what you do. There are plenty of atheists who claim to be theist or act like theist. There are clergy people, this is why we have the Clergy Project, who are actually atheists and yet still stand up in the pulpit. So we're really asking two different questions. Yes, there are people who may become an atheist and then go back to being a theist, but there's also people who may go back to acting like a theist. You were talking about going to church and things like that. That's completely separate from what you believe about God. You could believe that it's in your best interest to go to church, participate in that community, because it alleviates family conflicts and all that. And that's what Phil and I were talking about earlier, and what Phil's talking about now is the people who can come out, we'd love for them to do so because it makes it easier for other people who don't feel safe coming out. Just like if you're gay, you can act straight. Doesn't change who you are.
All right.
You can hide it. You can have a beard. You can be a gay man married with kids and just keep this secret life because the world isn't safe for you yet, or you're just not comfortable being as out about it as other people. Those are separate issues, what you believe and what you do.
All right. Do you think in, like, I don't know, obviously you're not fortune tellers, but do you think in 20 to 30 years, do you see atheism becoming more normalized? Like, I guess now it's not nearly as bad as it was maybe in the 50s and 60s after the war, where we're sort of going through a pretty religious time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just do you see just at least in America, in the U.S., do you see it changing?
Absolutely.
Becoming more normal?
I would definitely think so. The amount of people that are out doing, you know, shows like this, other secular organizations or free thought communities or atheist organizations that are actually out and doing work in their communities and exposing more and more people to the fact that people, a lot of population doesn't actually believe in a deity, and yet they are still good people, you know, doing good things, or living their lives just as normally as these believers are. And so I think as more organizations start, you know, popping up, as people feel more comfortable starting those organizations in their neck of the woods where it hasn't existed before, it's easy, like for Austin, for somebody to, you know, I'm going to start an atheist organization here, but, well, let's go to a small town out in Texas. It's a lot more difficult on this side. But as more people start making those organizations and getting that word out there, you know, Pew Research doing those surveys where they're looking at the religiosity of the population over time and putting that information out there that people aren't believers, as atheists become a larger voting bloc and a more visible voting bloc, in my mind, I hope that it would start normalizing things to where it might be easier for people down the line to come out and not have to have so much fear about the backlash they'll receive in their personal or professional lives.
All right.
I think all the data shows that the trend is towards a more secular world. That doesn't mean that we're not going to, you know, vacillate, that there'll be setbacks. It'll become more secular and then less, but the general trend is towards a more secular world. And at a minimum, with regard to your concerns, largely we are constantly moving towards more atheist normalcy, more acceptance of people who are non-believers. Since the 50s, when the Supreme Court ruled on whether or not atheists could run for office, and the answer is yes, we can. It doesn't matter what your state constitution says, that's already been overturned by Supreme Court ruling. But generally speaking, you had this spike in the U.S. in Christian fundamentalism, and there's been a reaction to that, both from moderate and liberal theists and from the secular non-theistic community. And what we've seen is, if you look back to when Madeleine Murray O'Hara was creating, you know, American Atheist, and she's on TV and she's talking about these things, she was the most hated woman in America. And that's just what she was called. That's generally what she was. And she was fighting a fight, and she was sometimes awful and sometimes wonderful. But there weren't a lot of people doing it. Now we live in an era where not only are there more people doing it, but there's far more opportunities. I mean, this show is going to be, it's live streaming to YouTube. There's countless YouTube atheists. You're seeing more and more events where secularists are engaging in conversation. I do a ton of them. Pangburn Philosophy is putting on a bunch of them. You've got Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, other people who are booking a theater to sit down and talk about these issues and drawing crowds of thousands that wouldn't have happened in the early 90s. It wouldn't have. It certainly wouldn't have happened in, you know, the 70s or 80s. We lost a little bit. If you go back to the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, when Colonel Ingersoll was speaking, you know, he spoke at the Republican National Convention. He was the great agnostic. He was in newspapers having arguments, debates with preachers. He gave these great orations to large crowds. And then we had sort of a reversion, and things got more conservative. Things got more fundamentalist for a while. You're going to go through those trends, but I think all the data show that we're getting closer and closer to maybe a tipping point on atheist, on a secular world, but certainly I think we're close to a tipping point on atheist normalcy.
That's really, I don't know, that's nice to hear, I guess. I think that's all of my questions.
Cool.
I wanted to, oh, sorry.
No,
go for it.
Go ahead.
Oh. I was just going to say, also, thank you. You guys are the reason my husband is now an atheist. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. But he's the reason he's an atheist. We just talk. There's okay, a thousand other people who heard us say the same things he did, and they didn't change their mind. But
that's fair.
We are happy to do this. And I hope things get easier for you. And I appreciate the call. And hopefully, you know, I wasn't too intimidating.
No. I'm just glad I'm not a theist trying to convince you of anything.
Well, we'll get back to that next. Take care, Anna. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All right.
That's, you know, getting back to the first call, when we were talking about what's the purpose of the show.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a purpose. The ultimate goal is to make the show and atheist activism obsolete because we live in a better world. But it's, you know, the theist calls often, we try to make them take priority.
Yeah.
They also get the most attention and the most views. But we also are happy to talk to other atheists, agnostics, freethinkers, seculars, whatever label you want to use.
The community.
Because if we didn't engage in that, if this was just argue with theists for an hour and a half, I don't think that we'd be making the progress that we are, because we're building communities. There, you know, you've got Oasis and Sunday Assembly and Atheist Community and Secular Community and Skeptics at the Pub and Freethinking Organizations, and then you have charitable things like Foundation Beyond Belief, Atheists Helping the Homeless, Humanists at Work, the RAMP Project, Blood Drives, all of these things. We're showing that religions have had a privileged position in the West in particular, and worldwide. In some cases, you have straight-up theocracies. And this put them in an unfair position, such that when people thought about good,
right, yeah,
when they thought about charity, when they thought about things that were beneficial to their communities, they thought about churches. Because in a church, synagogue, whatever, you have a building. You have a community center. Yes, it's founded around religion, but it fills a lot of voids in the community. And the one thing I've talked about before is, when I was a Southern Baptist, if I packed up and left Austin and moved to, you know, I don't know, San Antonio, there's a Baptist church there, a dozen, probably within a few miles of me, that I could go to, and I've got a ready-made, built-in community where I just have to say, yep, I'm a Baptist, and I'm in like Flint. Mm. We are working to build similar things in the atheist community. It's going to take some time, in part because we don't have the privileged status that religion has. We don't have de facto tax-free, you know, and the churches are hiding the money in their books and you don't have to be public about it. But we're starting, you know, it's like we gave religion a 1,000-year head start. And if you look at the progress that we've made just in the last 20 years on building communities and increasing activism and building secular organizations and charities, it's astounding. And I think that speaks volumes to both how the world is changing and how this show, the various other shows, the conversations and the projects that we work on are changing the world. We'll get there. And as long as we don't, like, blow ourselves up first.
Yeah. One show at a time.
Yeah. Or melt.
Yeah.
But, yeah. We've got Chris in Phoenix. Thanks for waiting. You're on with Matt and Phil.
Hey, guys. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Oh, I appreciate you guys taking my phone call. Basically, I'm just, I don't know, I do believe in God, but being in the world that we are in today and seeing how Christians act, especially in the time of Trump here, it gets hard defending it because you see the actions of these people and you wonder, has anybody ever actually read the Bible? Do they study the Bible too? I mean, there's a difference between reading and studying, in my opinion.
I appreciate what you're saying, and I'm in agreement with you. As a former Christian, I'm baffled by the Christian support for Trump and a few other people and things. But when it comes to do they read the Bible, do they study the Bible, I was in church far too long to think that there are people who adequately and fairly study the Bible and remain in their religion. To me, the main question is whether or not it's true. That's the first question. And then what is it telling us? And how should we live our life? There's plenty of good things in the Bible that could guide people to take action. I just don't think that the Bible is required in order for people to do good things or live a better life. And I think that the negative baggage in it kind of wipes out much of the good that's there. But at the end of the day, if it's not true, then it does no good to say, oh, don't kill people because the Bible says so. If it turns out that there is no God, that the Bible isn't telling the truth about the supernatural and the divine or the foundations of morality, then you have to come up with another reason to not kill people. And it turns out it's really easy to do so. And so the Bible isn't necessary. But yeah.
When I read the Bible, I look at the Bible, and when I read it, I don't look at God as a perfect being. And I think, when I talk to any other Christian in the world, I feel like I'm big time in the minority on that. I believe that God made mistakes with humans in the Old Testament. And I think the covenants prove that. He would curse generations to the third and fourth generation. Well, that would mean, if my great-grandpa, who I've never met, if he sinned against God, well, I'm cursed forever. I have no chance.
Well, that goes right back to the beginning. We're all cursed because of what Eve supposedly did.
I know.
But the thing here is, the Bible portrays God as perfect. At least in the Psalms, it talks about his way is perfect.
Well, that's anecdotal, too. That's David talking about all the problems that he had and the stupid things he did, and God rescued him from that because he's from, the proper lineage, the line, line. So he basically gets rescued over and over, so he portrays God as perfect. That's anecdotal. That's not proof that God is perfect.
Well, okay, so now you've put two carts in front of the horse. Because the first question, okay, you've got the Bible, and the Bible is portraying God as perfect or whatever, and you've decided that God's not perfect. But why on earth would you think there's a God anyway? And if God's not perfect, then you have to say, okay, is God more good than bad? Is he wise at all? Is there any reason for me to pay attention to him, to think that he's authoritative? And all of that is predicated on the notion that a God exists. So for me, I see no reason to think that a God exists. I see no reason to think that the character of God as presented in the Bible or the Quran or a number of other religions is the sort of character that I should really be concerned with as to whether or not, if God says do this or don't do this, my response is, why should I care what God says to do or not do? If God isn't going to demonstrate that he exists and then demonstrate his goodness, then the God that doesn't do that is just as relevant to my life as a God that doesn't exist at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, he demonstrated himself to the people all over the Old Testament, over and over and over.
I mean, thousands of times
he showed himself to the people.
No, there
and
are...
He kept turning...
There are stories. There are stories that claim that God revealed himself.
That's what I mean. Right. I know that. I'm not here to prove God exists. There's no way I can prove he exists. There's no way I can prove he doesn't exist.
Hang on. Those two things aren't equal.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If there's no way to prove that God exists, what justification can you possibly have for believing it?
Because I don't believe that I honestly don't believe that. Because to me, it's easier to believe that there is always a God as opposed to this just came from absolutely nothing. Now, whether I believe that the Bible is historically accurate or not, this is man who wrote it. I can't sit there and take seriously what man has written.
So you,
I just can't. But I can also, but I can still believe that a God exists.
You can believe whatever you want. I'm asking whether or not that belief is rationally justified. And when I asked why would you believe in something that you
well,
say
what's the rational that believing you, that God doesn't exist.
No, Chris.
That God doesn't exist.
It may not be rational to believe that God doesn't exist. I'm asking, the burden of proof is on the claim. God exists or God doesn't exist. They both have a burden of proof. But if nobody can prove that God exists and there cannot be a rational reason to believe that God exists, then it is irrational for me to believe that God exists.
But you want proof of either. That's
no.
Impossible.
Tough.
You want proof.
Tough. It doesn't matter what you want. Chris, it doesn't matter what.
Chris. It doesn't work that way.
Chris. It doesn't matter what you want. Sometimes the only answer is, I don't know.
Agreeing to that there's no way to possibly 100% know.
I'm not saying, Chris.
Scientists that are out there trying to prove
Chris,
the planet was
stop.
Created from nothing.
I'm not talking about 100% anything. Can you see the TV?
No, I'm not watching the TV. I would shut the thing off.
Okay. So in my hand, I have a jar that is full of gumballs. I'm holding it up so that people can see it. Would we agree that, given that there's a quantity of gumballs in here, that the number of gumballs is either even or odd?
Could it be either even or odd? Of course it could be.
It can only be either even or odd, correct?
Correct.
Okay. If somebody writes a story and says the number of gumballs in this jar is even, and they have no evidence for that, do you believe that the number is even?
These are really stupid questions, because once again, you're trying to compare gumballs to God, dude. You can't compare gumballs to God.
So I'm asking a supposed Baptist preacher, Chris,
you're acting kind of ignorant yourself when it comes to this topic. You just keep trying to shift questions in a different direction.
I'm sorry that asking a simple yes or no question based on facts that you've agreed to is too difficult for you. If somebody writes a book...
Tell me where... What,
goodbye,
what
jackass. Here, let me finish my point. Maybe Chris will hear this someday. If somebody writes a book and says... Or, hey, somebody says, Phil tells me there's an even number of gumballs in this jar. Does that mean that I believe that it's even? No. I might believe, I might not. We'd have to establish what sort of evidence is required. But if I'm not convinced that the number is even, then I do not believe that the number is even. And if I do not believe the number is even, does that mean that I believe it's odd? No, it doesn't. Am I comparing gumballs to God? Only a sense that these are fucking real, and I can demonstrate it, and I can count them. And when I do that, then I will have evidence to believe whether or not this is even or odd. If your justification for believing in God is because nobody can prove God's not even, nobody can prove that God doesn't exist, you're essentially saying that you're going to believe it's even because people can't prove it's odd. That's the point. This isn't a dumb example from somebody who wanted to be a preacher and who's just monumentally ignorant. This is straight up logic 101. This is about establishing a claim and a burden of proof, and then determining what standards of reasonableness are required to reach a conclusion. It's not my fault that you refuse to do that with respect to God. And what's sad is, as soon as your brain realizes that you are going to have to admit that you don't do that with respect to God, and you are going to have to acknowledge this conflict, all of a sudden, the gumball example became just, this is just stupid. You're comparing gumballs to God. That's a nice defense mechanism. But if that's what it takes to make you think that you're being rational when you're not, you've demonstrated that you are engaged in self-delusion, that you don't know or care about what is reasonable to believe. By dismissing the simplest example of claims, burden of proof, and evidence, by suggesting that, oh, well, you're comparing gumballs to God and blah, 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 and that's not fair, and you might make me admit that I don't actually have a good reason. No, you already admitted you didn't have a good reason, because when I asked you, you said, I just can't believe that there wasn't a God always here. I just can't believe that stuff came about without a God.
That it's easier.
Yeah, it's easier to believe. Those are all arguments from ignorance and convenience. They are all fallacious. They get you nowhere with regard to whether or not your belief is justified, or they don't get you anywhere closer to being justified. If anything, every one of your answers demonstrates that your conclusion is wholly unjustified. It is rooted in fallacies, and I'm sorry that it makes you uncomfortable to be faced with logic. But we've got Austin in Florida.
Hey, y'all. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So I'll just go get straight to the point. My question is, if you were creating the laws for a society, how would you go about convincing people to follow or believe in your laws?
Okay. So the first thing that would need to happen is to demonstrate what the goal is and how those laws work towards that goal. If you can convince people that the goal is a healthier, happier, more productive society where there's less conflict, because conflict harms us. You know, I would never go to a basis of simple harm, because there's going to be problems with all of it. But if you get people convinced that the goal is, as I would describe it, well-being, then you can show how the laws that you put forth or the rules that you're going to put forth either further the notion of well-being, harm well-being, or have little to no effect on well-being. And probably the best method to get people, or one of the best methods to get people to realize this, is John Rawls' Veil of Ignorance. And that plays on people's innate sense of fairness by removing as much bias as it can. And essentially, it just says, design the society that you would be willing to live in, not knowing who you are in that society. So that, hey, we're going to have a law about slavery. Is slavery legally permissible? Or it doesn't matter whether we call it legal or moral. We'll just say, is the rule that slavery is okay or that slavery is bad? And if you design a system not knowing whether you're going to be the slave or the slave owner, generally speaking, I would argue that any rational, empathetic person who actually understands and cares about well-being would say, nope, we can't allow slavery if for no other reason than I might end up being a slave. That veil of ignorance removes a lot of the bias and baggage that we evaluate, and you make a case for your proposed rules, your proposed better society.
I like that. It's a good thought experiment.
I wish it was mine.
I do have a concern with it, though. Mm-hmm. So you talk about the well-being of society as a whole, and I think, you know, rational people can get behind that. However, when it comes to choosing between what's better for the society as a whole and choosing what's better for yourself, why would you, what rationale would you have to tell someone to choose the well-being for the society as a whole?
Yep, that is absolutely the biggest sticking point in this, is that when we look at well-being, hey, this could really benefit me, but might harm society. So how do I weigh my well-being against the well-being of society? There's not a simple answer. There's no simple calculus we can do to sort that out. But the big thing to do is to realize that if I'm focused primarily on my well-being, there's no problem with that as long as I'm able to evaluate all of the broader consequences. So I guess the easiest way to do it is to say it like this. I live in society, and my actions have consequences for myself and for other people. And I have to be able to not live myopically and focus on my own life, because what may be in my short-term best interest could be long-term incredibly harmful for me. And what we need to engage in is a level of humility that we do not possess the ability or the data to evaluate all possible consequences. And so you go back to the veil of ignorance of saying, if I understand that this person wants to rob this bank and that'll be in their short-term interest, but what does that do to everybody else? And is it actually in their best interest? Because if the interest rate that you earn goes down and the cost of banking goes up and it begins to affect the rest of society, all of a sudden your money becomes less and less valuable. And it's our inability to look at those broader consequences that make us think things are in our best interest when they might not be. And you can make a case that if you ignored what was in your immediate best interest and focused on what made the world better as a whole, you are still improving and you are still getting a better life out of it, because now the entire world, which you are part of, is improved. Are you as improved as you might be if you were selfish about it? Possibly not, but you might also be more damaged in the long term by being selfish that way.
I do like that, and I think it's a good way of looking at it. It does feel a little kind of like an ivory tower argument. Like, so I'm on the ground, and you're telling me there's never a situation when I should break the law for my own interest, because whenever I help the society, it will always help myself. I mean, I'm sure I could come up with a situation
You're part of it.
Helping myself would hurt society, but it sounds like you don't have a great way of telling that person who has a choice between helping themselves and helping society why they should help society, which I think would be good to be able to do if you're creating laws.
It would be nice if there were much easier, pithier answers for that, but... First of all, when it comes to morality and ethics, they are situational. When Katrina hit, there were people who were engaged in what was being called looting. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, if you're running in your boat and you're stockpiling TVs to sell after the water recedes, that's looting. You're not doing anything. But if you're boating by a store and you're in this terrible situation and you need food... stealing bread that's going to spoil anyway, is it still theft? Yes, it's still theft, but it may be the most moral action that you could possibly take. Just like, you know, the old anecdote of there's a defibrillator, you know, in the window of a store and the guy next to you is having a heart attack. You shouldn't even take a second or two's thought that you break the glass if the store is closed and locked up and you get the defibrillator and you make amends afterwards. It doesn't matter that you did something wrong to achieve something better. You had a better look at the picture.
Hmm. All right. Well, yeah, it sounds like you originally your response was, well, you should do what's better for society because it will most likely help you in the long run. And now it sounds like you're saying you should do what you weigh in your heart as right.
No. This isn't weigh in my heart in that sense. I mean, To some extent, that would be relying on my conscience alone, which is always, my conscience is always going to be the guide. I'm going to have to be convinced. But I'm talking about an assessment of the situation based on as many factors as possible with respect to a goal of well-being. This is how you weed out the psychopaths who say, well, it's my opinion that it's in my best interest to slaughter these four people. You don't just get to look at it from the standpoint of an individual and an individual's opinions. This is why I point out that while morality is situational, within each situation there is still a best set of possible actions, and those aren't subjective. They're not a matter of opinion. It's just it's a matter of fact. You can be wrong about what is or isn't the best course of action.
Okay, so yeah, it's interesting that we've gotten to objective morality. I've always thought this is a fascinating topic and talked with a few atheist friends about it. I mean, Phil, I heard you earlier say you want to help show people that atheists are good people doing good things. And I'm behind that as well. And Matt, when you were talking to Nicholas, you said that you agree that there's evil in the world and talked about its societal implications. It seems like a lot of atheists that I talk to will use objective moral terms when it's convenient for them, but then, you know, obviously, or not obviously, but typically would say that there is no objective morality. Seems kind of like a double standard.
Well, you'll have to take it up with them, because I've been advocating for situational morality and non-subjective morality. I think one of the points where people get a lot confused is when they hear objective morality, they confuse that with absolute morality, in the sense that it is always wrong under all circumstances to take something that isn't yours. That is an absolute statement about a moral thing. And instead, what I'm arguing is that it's situational, but within, there's a finite number of options one can take in any given situation. Some set of one or more of those represent the worst thing you can do, and some set of one or more of those represent the best thing that you can do.
Right.
And it, whether or not it's good or bad, that assessment can be made objectively. When you have a standard of well-being, it's no longer a matter of opinion. It's either a fact or not. And it doesn't mean we know what the right answer is. We can be in a position where we are completely, we don't have enough information, we're not able to actually accurately assess what is the right thing. Nobody advocating for secular ethics, or at least not that I'm aware of or anybody who's thought about it, is pretending that we have come up with the answer to every moral quandary ever. What we're doing is saying a secular moral system is predicated on these foundations, which remove as much bias as we can, that set a foundation of well-being which is non-subjective. You know, I could have the opinion all day that cutting off Phil's head is good for him, but it's just a matter of fact as to whether or not it is good for him.
Right. Okay. I mean, yeah, this gets down to the crux of my question, which is using, how do you convince someone of a standard of objective morality? And I'm not saying absolute morality. I'm saying, agree with your definition that in a situation, there's always a better thing to do. I agree with that. I would try to convince other people of that. But I think you, as an atheist, when in the brutal reality of the world, your outlook is, you stop that well-being. Well, if you go a step backwards, you say, well, why does the well-being of humanity matter?
It doesn't matter. It's not like there's some rule or requirement for the universe to care about well-being.
Right.
My argument is.
But it sounds like your goal.
Asking
your goal is well-being, and not everyone would agree to that goal.
Tough. That's the point that you have to convince them on. You don't have to convince them on the rest of it. You have to convince them that, yes, we, in fact, do and should care about well-being. And I think the overwhelming...
Even though it doesn't matter.
It matters to us. It doesn't intrinsically matter. There's nothing about the universe that requires that we care about this. It is in our best interest to care about this. And if the counter argument is to say, why should I care about what's in our best interest? Well, because it's in your best interest. If you don't care about that, if you don't care about that, I don't know what could make you care about that. But I think anybody who says they don't care about that is lying, because the people who don't care about that don't care about living.
Right. That's true. I would pessimistically say, though, that there's, I think that you all, you, Phil, Matt, I don't want to speak for you, but I would say, you value rationality and basing your life off truth highly. But it sounds like when it gets down to ethics, you say, we know it's not true, but we're going to care about it anyway.
No. Yeah. Acknowledging that I acknowledge that there's nothing about the universe that intrinsically requires or mandates that we care about well-being does not mean that it's not true that it's in our best interest to care about this, and that we do in fact care about this.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess, and that does cover a lot of things.
Because the objection that you're getting to, which has been dealt around this, is people say, okay, we want to use well-being as the foundation. And then somebody say, why should we care about well-being? Well, there's no objection that one can raise to this secular value system that doesn't also apply to every other proposed solution. Why should we care what God says?
I think that your situation, your ethics that you're providing covers a lot of situations. I would just say there's a tricky one where someone has a chance to better their personal well-being at the expense of society. And then when you talk about societal well-being, they say, I don't care, it's not intrinsically valuable. And so with that person, it doesn't seem like you have a way forward with convincing them.
But now, as I noted...
What's different about my...
Well, see, you say I don't have a way forward in convincing them. I don't know how you can make that claim. Do you think that just because somebody is wrong, that they can't be convinced?
Well, okay. Well, what makes you say that this person is wrong? So they have a choice between their personal well-being and it might hurt society. Like, most people would agree it's going to hurt society in the long run.
Austin, this isn't about what most people agree on. This is about what the fact is.
Okay, sure. So it's factually true that society will be worse off for this person making themselves better off.
Right.
And then you tell them we should care about the society's well-being. That's
right.
Why you shouldn't do this.
Because
well-being doesn't matter to me.
They're wrong, and you can demonstrate that. They're wrong, Austin, and you can demonstrate that by pointing out exactly how the well-being of society does affect them. You could have all the money in the world, and if you did, it would be useless.
True. Yeah. Well, but now we're back in a circle to you saying the only logical way is to say in every situation is to tell people in every situation the society's well-being will always help you. And I'm sure both you and I can agree that there's some situations where people can do things for themselves which make themselves better and will make themselves better for their whole life, but will leave society worse off.
I have not remotely stated that that's not a possible factual scenario.
Okay, so let's say my hypothetical scenario is that scenario. So they can demonstrate to you, actually the situation, no matter what, is going to help me in the long run. I will be better off for it, but society will be worse off for it.
I am not remotely convinced that that could be demonstrated because you are a part of society.
Okay, so now we're... Okay, I guess I could try to come up with some hypothetical situation. So you're saying there is no possible way that there's a situation...
That's not what I said. I'm not convinced that that's possible. So when I acknowledged that nobody's pretending that we have all the answers, and I would never pretend that I understand every possible scenario of benefit to an individual versus society at all. I would need an example. What we're engaged in right now is, let's say that hypothetically there was a situation in which somebody does something that benefits them and it harms society, but the impact on society doesn't have any sort of impact on them for the rest of their life.
Well, I mean, I would argue that I think most people listening to the show could conceive of at least one situation, if not...
I would love for somebody to actually conceive of one and be specific, but sure. That doesn't happen. We just talk about a hypothetical possibility, which I'm not sure is the case, because every time somebody's tried to present one of these, it ends up being short-sighted. They fail to recognize the broader impact on society and how it does affect them. Now, the way to get to that is to say, I'm going to die tomorrow, and so tonight I'm going to go on an awful... I'm gonna rob 5 banks. I'm gonna steal the money. I'm gonna go out and spend it all on hookers and cocaine and everything else, and just make my last 24 hours the most fun that it can possibly be. And even if there is an effect on society, that will never affect me. That's the closest we can get to that scenario.
Okay. That's an interesting hypothetical.
Yeah,
I would say maybe another scenario would be someone who lives in a town and has to choose between joining an oppressive mafia or submitting to torture or something like that.
I don't know how that example gets anywhere near. I came up with what I thought was about the best case where you can say that this benefits me and can't possibly.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I think we both came up with, you know, certain hypothetical situations. I think.
But the issue here is, the issue here was, how could I go about convincing that person they were wrong? And the answer is, maybe I can't. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't change whether or not they're actually wrong. Because we go back to the veil of ignorance. Anytime I'm trying to evaluate whether or not an action is good or not, one of the things I always do is I say, what would the world be like if everybody were to do exactly what I want to do right now?
I've heard that, yeah. And I think that's a good way of going about it.
And that's as close as I can get to convincing people. I don't think it's nearly as hard to convince people to care about well-being and to care about a broader society. It may not, there may be situations where you can't do it. There may be situations where there's no way to show somebody that they're actually wrong about the consequences of their action. Or there may be a case like my hypothetical where it's just impossible. Pointing to outliers is never a good use of our time when broadly speaking, it is not difficult to get people to understand why they should care about others, why they should care about society, and to give them the basic tools that will help them make better decisions, not perfect decisions. It's not necessarily a tool set that's going to answer every single question, but it is vastly superior to any religious system, which actually religious moralities aren't systems, they're proclamations. And so the process by which I'm advocating a secular moral system is superior to everything every religion has ever proposed.
Well, it's interesting that you would say a few things. You'd say that, well, one, that it sounds like you're saying it's objectively superior, which we've already agreed that the humanity's well-being is not an objective matter.
No. We did not agree to that. I have said repeatedly that it is.
Well, you said that there's an objective. You can decide there's an objective way to better well-being. But I said, taking a step back, well, does well-being of humanity matter? And the answer is no.
Right, but no, so, that objection, as I pointed, that objection, as I pointed out, applies to every proposed religious solution as well. There's no objection to secular morality proposed by advocates of a religious system that doesn't also apply to theirs or that just simply isn't true.
Okay, well, I just got you to admit, and when you just said that we cannot, that we don't have a way of convincing that person who's going to say,
correct,
I want it better myself.
I said there may not be any way to convince that person.
Well, okay, so I would say one disadvantage that your system has is there's not something that could weigh on someone such that they would choose against their personal well-being.
That's true for religious systems as well. If the guy wants to go out in his last 24 hours and do all kinds of harm that benefits him, the religious solutions don't solve that problem either.
Well, yeah, sure. But if he was to subscribe to the religious view, he would think, even I want to do this, my last rally.
No. This is the dishonest.
It's wrong.
Austin, this is the dishonest part of the problem.
Really wrong.
The honest, Austin, this is the dishonest portion of your argument, because you just said,
okay, go ahead,
if he were to subscribe to the religion, that, to put that co-equal with mine, it would be if he were to agree about well-being. You don't get to point to the outliers to fault my system and then exclude the outliers to benefit yours.
Right, but my, so your system says to put aside rationality and choose an arbitrary goal.
No, my position does not put aside rationality at any point. Religious systems do.
Well, I was saying if you set your goal as human well-being, then your system is very rational. I agree, but setting your goal as human well-being, I don't think you can say is rational.
You can't say that caring about what God says is rational. That's the point. You're raising an objection. You're raising an objection to mine that applies equally to yours, and actually applies more so to yours, because among the population there are more people who are going to care about well-being than there are about a God.
I mean, I guess that's a claim that can be discussed. I don't think.
No, it's a fact.
True.
It's a fact, because there is a billion Christians, there's a billion Muslims, and there's a billion atheists, let's just say. And 90% of all of them care about well-being. And so the ones that also care about God are adding a second problem to them caring about well-being. You are, the God problems, the God proposals don't solve the problems you're objecting to, and they make them worse by compounding it. They violate Occam's razor.
Okay, so if this person, you know, were to believe that there was a God, then that means they believe that their last day of living does have consequences. Whereas if this person did not believe that, then they know.
And if this person believes,
and
if this person believes and cares about what happens to the people they leave behind, then they'll know there's consequences too.
All right. Well, so it sounds like you're getting back to the care about societal well-being thing, which...
Holy shit, Austin.
I mean,
I'm pointing out that you are raising objections that are not not solved by your proposed solution.
Okay, well,
I gave a hypothetical scenario where someone could be convinced of this, and it may be factual that the impact on society isn't going to impact them directly. Now, if that person... If that person also happens to care about their family members and what kind of life they're going to leave afterwards, that is another factor that can be considered, just as if they care about an afterlife is another factor that can be considered. Both of those things, the one for my system, could play into this person's thought processes, and your thing about an afterlife could play into their thought processes. The only difference is mine is actually known to be a fact and yours isn't.
That's interesting. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because you've acknowledged that, let me say what I'm going to say. You've acknowledged that in terms of facts, that if you really get down to it, human thriving and well-being, it doesn't matter.
It matters to us. You keep saying it doesn't matter. It matters to us. I'm saying that there's nothing about the universe that requires that we care about it.
Right. Yeah.
And this has nothing to do with the point I just made.
And you all, as rational people, should be the ones who care the most about what actually matters in terms of objective universal truth. And it seems like you're suspending that belief in order to put forward this moral system.
Do you believe in God, Austin?
I do, yes.
Yeah. So you don't get to talk to me about suspending belief. Okay, you don't get to talk to me about rational, because if we both care about well-being, and I acknowledge that I don't have a grounding, an intrinsic grounding within the universe for well-being, and that it is merely in our best interest, and you say, or you suggest, that you have a grounding for well-being, and it's God, you are the one that is suspending rationality. To claim a foundation that you cannot demonstrate.
So you're kind of changing subjects here. It sounds like you're saying, I don't have a good answer, so I'm going to critique your view. Which is
Holy shit! I'm pointing out that every objection you raise to secular morality is not solved at all by your version, and now you're claiming that because I don't have a good answer, I'm critiquing yours. You don't have a good answer. Don't pretend that you have a better answer.
Can I just kind of summarize and then I'll let someone else talk? Is that okay?
What do you need to summarize?
I'm sorry, I didn't want to cut you off.
I'm just trying to figure out what you need to summarize.
Sure, yeah. I was saying that I don't think we have the same problem. I think we have a different problem. So whereas my problem is the person needs to believe in God, and we can argue, you would say, well, that's ridiculous. Why would anyone believe in God? Sure.
No, that's...
The person has to believe in God for this to apply.
Yeah, and the person needs to believe in well-being for this to apply.
Sure, yeah, but I'm saying once they believe in God, then it's set. They believe that there's intrinsic human value. They believe that, like...
It doesn't matter whether it's intrinsic. It doesn't matter whether it's intrinsic. Once they believe in God, your statement is once they believe in God, they believe in human value. And I'm saying once they believe in well-being, they believe in human value. Okay? So the problem is...
Well, but if we get down to it, then if they really believe in God, then at their core, they believe that human beings have real worth. And I think that's more important than just saying human beings have worth because I want them to.
Okay, so you can also convince people that for any other lie other than religion. You need to demonstrate that it's actually true. You don't just get to say, hey, if people believe in God, this changes them at their core, and that's a good thing. Because I don't give a shit if it's a good thing for people to believe in God. I care about whether or not it's true. Because if it's ultimately not true, then it's not a good thing.
That's interesting that you would say that.
I've said it for 14 years on this show. How is it interesting?
And I'm not sure how believing in a God, and you're saying that because someone believes in God, that makes them, you know, value humans versus from a secular standpoint of actually looking at the world around us, looking at the society that we're living in, and recognizing that people around me do have value. They bring something to the table. We all do in the society that we're trying to make better for ourselves. And coming to that conclusion that humans have value is somehow less than if I believed in a deity, and that how somehow changed me at my core to believe that
it gets worse than that, because now you're cherry picking. Because what else happens if people believe in God?
I just want to acknowledge what you said. I agree, and I think, and I'm not, and I hope you don't think I'm implying that atheists don't care about human beings.
No, we're not. That's a complete deflection. What else happens if people believe in God?
I mean, all sorts of other things.
All sorts of other good things, or are there some bad things too?
There are definitely bad things.
Okay.
The truth of I guess what I came on air to talk about, and I'd love to call back, actually, this has been awesome, but what I came on to talk about was by what authority do you convince people of your ethical framework?
The authority of the evidence and the physical facts about reality.
Well, you keep going back to reality, but we both know that.
Because that's all we have.
It's true.
But you don't get to object to me dealing and going back to reality by proposing something beyond reality. That is asinine.
Well, the very thing that you're using to defend your ethical views is the thing that makes it weak. That if you just look at
it doesn't matter if you view it as weak, Austin. Yours is weaker by definition. By definition, if I'm dealing with reality and you're saying that's not enough, it's weak, I need to go ahead and accept something beyond reality that makes it stronger, you are wrong. It makes it weaker. It makes it weaker until you can demonstrate that it's real.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. I also think that...
What could be stronger? What could be stronger than a framework firmly rooted in the physical facts of reality?
I mean, I think that we have a different view on what reality is.
You don't get to do that. You don't get to object to me being stuck in reality and saying it's too weak. What could be stronger than reality?
I mean, I'm with you there that we need to base our frameworks off of reality.
Jesus, you just said that was weak.
No, I'm saying. What you're saying is my framework is reality. Now, what's stronger than that? Well, I don't agree with you. I don't think your framework is reality.
You just said that my framework was reality and that it was weak. Go back and watch. We're done. I will go round and round. But rewind the damn tape. It's not a tape. How old am I? Rewind the show. To where you accused me, you said that I keep going back to reality, and you noted that that was a weak foundation. I don't know why I'm still talking to him. I already hung up on him.
And somehow believing in a deity makes it stronger. I'm not understanding that. Like, I made the point about the human values force because I don't understand how believing in a deity and that somehow makes us believe that human values, somehow that's better. Yeah. Actually looking around us and coming to that conclusion based on the reality around us.
This is the common thing. This is why for years, whenever I've addressed this, I point out that every objection you can launch with respect to a reality-based secular moral foundation is not in any way solved by appealing to a God. It's just not. You can say, hey, if people believe in God, this might change them at their core so that they care more about this. Okay, fine. I can also say that for any other lie. The concern is whether or not God is true. The foundation may, in fact, produce the result that you desire, but that doesn't change whether or not the foundation is a better foundation with respect to the facts of reality. And if I'm making an argument that is based in reality, and your position is, oh, well, there's no reason within reality for us to care about well-being, and I say, yes, the only reason for us to care about well-being is because we care about well-being. because it's in our best interest, because we are the ones that want to continue living. If we don't care about that, there's nothing to force us to. Oh, well, what reason can you give somebody to care about that? By pointing out to them that they're a living being and that this benefits them if they'd like to continue living. It's pretty much self-evident. Doesn't mean you can convince everybody. Okay, well, I've got a system that will convince some of those people who don't accept yours. I'll just tell them there's a magic man in the sky that wants them to care about well-being. And I will say, number one, I don't believe in your magic man in the sky. And number two, even if he's real, why should I give a shit what he thinks? And so now we've got people who say, why should we care about well-being? And then you say, because God says so. And then the answer becomes, why should we care about what God says? You haven't solved the problem. In fact, you've made it twice as bad. That's the problem. Oh, well, your reality, you're just dealing with reality. It's weak. But I didn't say that. Yes, you did. Go back and watch again. We are over time, but I'm going to ask the callers to hang on because we're going to do after show stuff, which will probably go up on the Patreon at some point. And any atheist or atheist friendly person is welcome to come down to that address right there, as long as you get here fairly quick to eat and hang out.
Yes, I think it's tamales, I think, today.
Oh, yeah. I love tamales.
I think that's what's happening.
I'm a tamale guy. Anyway, yeah, on that note, I want to thank everybody for tuning in this week. Thank you, Phil. Thank you to the callers that made it and the people on the other side of the glass and the people on the other side of that wall who make the show happen.
Indeed.
We'll be back next week. I think Tracy Harris will be on.
Woo. Yeah, later.